Chapter 9, Human Systems, in which the reason for and the failings of human-created systems are gone into in a roundabout manner. When I was writing my previous book, The Songs of Peter Gray, and really going through my meeting past even more than I ever had before, one thing that really made me think was to remember how constantly the men in our meeting spoke negatively about human religious systems, the camp, or professing Christendom. A few older guys actually just called all Christianity outside our meeting system, and they had not one good or even neutral comment to make about those ensnared by system. How carefully they contrasted these systems, churches, charities, and Christian communities, with God's way, which we were following at our non-church, of course. And how absolutely everything they said and everything I knew about human systems, religious or otherwise, was also very true of my own meeting. Yet I'd been raised to never put it under that spotlight along with the rest. So I hadn't really. To suggest there was anything merely human about what went on in our meeting would definitely be heard as fighting words. But we were no better and no worse than any other human system out there. The thing about a system is that it is human-made rather than naturally occurring. Natural life may grow and repair itself. Things humans create start slowly crumbling and falling down about as soon as they're built. They require constant maintenance instead of being regenerating. They're pretty much just a pile of balanced bricks, and they aren't fond of change. Natural life has growth, movement, and energy at the heart of it. Systems mostly add structure by defining limits. In our country, for instance, we have a legal system. There are innumerable laws, and pretty much all of the laws take away, rather than grant, freedoms. And we're fine with that, because we want the liberty of other less trusted people to be carefully limited. We're so fine with this that we're willing to give up those same liberties ourselves just to make sure the wrong people don't have them. Every system, no matter what it claims, tends towards increasingly becoming anti-change. We need some systems, of course, but systems also have to be carefully limited or they'll subject everyone to tyranny. Tyranny is control taken so far as to be anti-life. And there is a distressing tendency for structure to become tyranny. In fact, positions which grant power and control more than all the other positions open to anyone seem to attract the very people who are most likely to become tyrants. More about anti-life. I'm a classroom teacher, and I have to keep kids in the room, in their seats, out of each other's stuff, attentive, quiet, and off their phones. It's actually really, really hard to do that. Now, if the kids were actually dead, all of those things would abruptly cease to be problems. If we just executed all of them, and they were all propped up in their chairs, gray, stiff, and cold, not one of those problems would trouble the room anymore. Control would be easy. All we'd have to sacrifice would be life itself. But of course, you need life if you want growth. And learning and education are supposedly serving growth. Much of what goes on in school isn't serving growth at all, but is necessary or is thought necessary in order to serve the interests of control, as evidenced by how much easier much of my day would be if students were actually dead. But growth is supposed to be going on and learning, not decay. So I prefer my students to be healthy, alive, and awake. Now, with all the Jordan Peterson videos I've been watching lately, I have become more acutely aware of the fact that the 20th century was mainly a secularizing century, which promised to bring a new era of liberty from all the old traditions, customs, and religious superstitious claptrap. What actually happened, obviously, is that the regimes most determined to rid their societies of traditions, aristocrats, religion, and other forms of structure all ended up with everyone under the thumbs of tyrants who brought obscene amounts of structure in instead of removing it all. Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, Kim Jong-il, and Mao Zedong spring to mind. These men caused more death in the name of freedom and prosperity and good, supposedly for the future of their countries, than anyone else we can easily think of. Control taken too far. This demonstrates that ideology will serve to do what many accuse religion of in terms of control, manipulation, fear, and power. You don't need a belief in God to be a tyrant. An ideology doesn't need to be a religion to be tyrannical, fanatical, and dogmatic. Tyranny on a small scale. Some people have the misfortune to live with, or work under, or go to church with someone who is clearly a tyrant, someone who seems to need to impose order, control, and structure so desperately that he clearly puts the needs of the people under his influence far below seeking to maintain the obsessive order to which he is so addicted. It can be a boyfriend, girlfriend, sibling, parent, spouse, boss, elder, or pastor. All decisions are made with a view to power and the power hierarchy. It's all about power and control and little else, though it pretends to be, for the common good. There are white knuckles on that steering wheel of what is clearly not even really a car. It generally involves micromanaging, like Stalin taking a personal interest in controlling female Soviets' access to underwear, or Kim Jong-un mandating a very limited number of specific government-approved male and female hairstyles permissible in North Korea. What makes someone fear not having that level of control, feel entitled to take it, and be allowed to do so? My main problem with my upbringing was that as to my father, and as to my meeting, and as to some of my teachers, this kind of teapot despotism was what I lived under. It was most sad when seen in my father trying to gain and maintain the approval of the meeting as to how he was raising his kids, though he didn't have a Brethren aristocracy last name. We were new godly, not old godly. It's like with old money, only with godly. In our home, he was really the messenger, passing on the rules and restrictions to us, not because they were good for us, but because he was trying to protect our family from any Brethren judgment, and also trying to win our family some respect, despite not having a solid Brethren pedigree and last name. Nothing was free from scrutiny. Everything from what shirt I could wear, to my hairstyle, to my music, to my shoes, speech patterns, posture, friends, and entertainment were all carefully, fearfully controlled. They were never good enough. I was trained to just know how the meeting system worked so I could be socially, sometimes physically, punished without anyone needing to even tell me what I'd done wrong. So many of us were raised to this, it seems. We all had to just know, and so we did. The success of this just-knowing training encouraged the leaders among us to present the just-knowing as very natural. If you just knew, then of course it was natural, very scriptural, of God. Only it wasn't. It was hammered into us relentlessly and was nothing if not systematic. No human system is natural, of course, though if they are sufficiently gentle and flexible, they can work very well with natural beings. Why are human systems inevitably flawed? They are set up and maintained by people. Every person is flawed and imperfect, and in the course of a given day, caught at various moments during that day, is no doubt going to be doing something stupid, dodgy, or weak. So a system run by a group of such individuals simply can't be expected not to drop the ball repeatedly in the course of a given day. It is our expectation of how they should work, spurred on by how most systems wish to claim they work and the image they try to present, that makes us frustrated when we look too closely at any human system, or worse yet, have personal dealings with or within it. I work in a high school, and so have a close-up view of how stupidly the education system sometimes tends to end up working by the time things have moved beyond the planning stage. Some people work in a hospital, or for the government, or a huge corporation, or the military. All say the same thing. If you have a close look at it, it's far from ideal. From a helicopter, the city is beautiful. Up close, there's dog crap and used condoms, and crime. I would go further and suggest that there are always people who fall through the cracks and people who get very badly served by any system. In fact, most systems have what have to be called victims, either of neglect or exploitation and oppression. My role in life, very often, is listening to and believing those kinds of people. The people who feel they've gotten neglected, sidelined, or actually badly mistreated by various human systems. Too often, systems try to shut people up and discredit them, or try to interfere with people like me listening or comforting. Someone like me being around, with no clear loyalty to the system in question, perhaps watching as light is shone under certain rocks, means I am often perceived as a threat. Certainly, if I talk or blog about some of what I learn, I am attacked for this. If I tell truth that isn't helpful to the system, people see me as a threat. For instance, I can't tell you how much trouble I would get in if I announced in the wrong circles that although schools annually celebrate rising graduation stats and modern classroom techniques, teachers daily see kids with less skill and knowledge than ever before. And as to churches and social programs, if I am going around believing victims, this provides evidence of the simple fact that a system has victims. I think the best thing about making this book has been giving victims a chance to be heard, albeit often with pseudonyms. Can't help but note how many voiceless, forgotten victims are women. Yesterday, I saw someone go on Facebook and angrily claim he'd been kicked out of his Brethren group for no good reason, claiming to have secretly recorded his meeting with the elders as evidence of what absolute suckers those Christian men were, and how much they abused their power. He was clearly beside himself. He was trying to get anyone to listen, anyone at all. He was offering to provide evidence that an abuse of power had occurred, and no one would listen for a moment. The people in his own group wanted him to shut up, and people outside his group did that Christian thing where they claimed that as he wasn't in their group, he was nothing to them, no obligation to try to love him. And predictably, people leapt in to comment that with bad language like that, he clearly deserved to be cast out as a wicked person consigned unto Satan for destruction of the flesh. A few people enumerated endless Bible verses to list in exhaustive detail exactly how many ways this man was wrong to not keep this matter private. And then Roy shared the fact that he'd been put away from his group of exclusive brethren for accusing an elder of having repeatedly used foul language in his presence. But John said, with language like Roy had used about that elder, they couldn't see how Roy could be a true Christian at all, because a Christian doesn't swear, right? The Bible says. I wonder what they'd have done if he'd called them sons of vipers and whitewashed sepulchers. When one guy came on and said how disdainfully disinterested he truly was in hearing this guy's story, given his language and endlessly quoted Ephesians, I commented that it sounded like he was quoting Ephesians as an excuse to be Galatians. Ephesians contains an exhortation about foul communication that Christians often use to police not the content, but merely the phrasing of things people say. Galatians talks about men who were putting the people in their assembly back under law, even though Christ had died to free them.